Hello, and thanks for joining us once again on Core Ideas, the podcast where we delve into all things related to lake sediments. My name is Adam Jaziorski, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend, Josh Steenbond.
Hello there, Adam. How is it going?
It's going pretty good. It's been a while.
It has been a while. We've talked a couple times, but it's been like a month since we posted the last episode. So it'd be like 5 weeks between episodes. Do you think anyone will notice? Think anyone Maybe. Noticed that we're missing?
It is the summer holidays.
Yeah. They'll just assume we're in the field or wherever.
Well, that or as things open up, went and visited parents again or family for the first time in a long time.
I've just been on a patio this entire time. but in fact, we were just taking a little bit of a break, a little reset. So I guess we were doing those things.
Yep, absolutely. No, and happily... Well, we'll see how the fall goes, but things definitely seem to be opening up. And I guess the end is in the air in terms of pandemicness.
The end of the current pandemic, touch wood. Let's see what happens. Cautiously optimistic, yeah. And if not, we keep rolling with it. Our remote podcasts, we will continue to provide this service that you can listen to wherever you are. But where were we, speaking of the last episode? I remember it was about diatoms, I believe, right?
Yeah, so we kind of like took an unofficial break in the middle of our new arc. We were just like, you know what? We're going to shelve this for a while.
We don't really know what we're doing. I don't think that's how you do it. You're supposed to break at the end of a segment.
Yeah, but we decided to focus for a while on the small things. Because we spent so much looking at like some big picture issues or the history of paleo. And so we decided to dedicate some individual episodes to actual paleo indicators. We began with pollen. Then we switched into diatoms. In some ways, on a quest to decide what the greatest paleo indicator actually is.
That's right. Even if we decided that last week or last time. but let us continue on this now... feeble search for the greatest paleo indicator with some
panderers.
Yes, that's right.
We will just say a little bit bigger. One is the greatest.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Great paleo indicators we shall look at either way. Let's continue with something a little bit bigger than the diatoms. We continue to increase in our size classes, not intentionally, but that seems to be how it's going. Let's talk about the cladocerans.
All right. So, cladocerans are something or a group that we've covered a couple times over the course of the show, and like in passing here and there, and we definitely gave a little bit of time to them in like our very first episode on bioindicators a lifetime ago. So now let's do just a little bit of a recap on what the cladocera are. Just let me pull up Wikipedia here.
Oh no, don't do it.
Unfortunately.
I looked the other day. There's like nothing there, man.
The Wikipedia page is nowhere near as detailed as the diatoms one.
Well, that gives you something to do. When you're done with all this podcast work, you can start flushing that out. And if anyone else out there wants to provide a service to the internet, they can do that. So what are we going to do? Where are we going to next?
Well, Plan B after Wikipedia and most of my research has been to reach for deeper or the developments in paleoecological research, paleoenvironmental research.
Yep. I
forget exactly
paleoenvironmental.
And in this case, Volume 4, Zoological Indicators, Chapter 2, which was written 2001. 2000?
Came out in 2001. Yeah, published. Probably written a little earlier, but
by Ade Korhola and Mila Rasio. And I would venture that compared to the diatoms, most people they may not realize it, but are a bit more familiar with the cladocera on a general sense in terms of having actually seen them with their eyes at some point in their lives.
You mean most people, like the general public, not your paleo community, just people you might find on the street. there's not a bad chance that they have seen a cladocerin in passing somewhere. I think you're right.
Absolutely. So anyone from our general neck of the woods that would have gone to a cottage in like the Muskoka, Trent Severn type areas of south central Ontario, if they've taken a scoop of lake water out and looked at it more closely, just even in a jar, you'll see all kinds of small invertebrates floating around in there. And some of them are likely to be members of the cladocerin. Like, you might not be able to make out very much in the way of details, but you can definitely make out the organisms with the naked eye. We're talking about things that range on the order of like half to a couple of millimeters big in size. Extreme ones in hard waters might be up to a centimeter, but I've never seen any of those. You won't find any of those around here. Some of them are actually quite famous, which we'll get to in the end in terms of their invasive qualities and media attention.
Yeah, those people ever pulled a little cup of pond water, especially not from the bigger lakes, but from some of the small ponds, may not have anything to eat. Those little gals, primarily, as we'll talk about. It's hard to miss them. The little thing swimming around, you may not be able to see it, but are going to be copepods or they're going to be big cladocerins. Absolutely. But from a taxonomic perspective, where do they fall in the hierarchy of life?
Okay, so they're invertebrates of the class Branchiopoda. So in other words, they are a order, and you'll sometimes see them referred in some places as a superorder of the crustaceans. And they are commonly known as water fleas. From a limnological point of view, they are a very major component of the zooplankton or the microscopic animal life within lakes. And they're also very abundantly preserved and easily found within the sediment record because the shells, the head shields, the post-abdomens, and the post-abdominal claws of these tiny crustaceans are among some of the most frequent animal remains that you'll find when examining lake sediments.
Yeah, and one of those paleolimnology indicators that's probably the most like uniquely limnological. There's really not a lot of marine cladocerin species in direct comparison to the copepods, which are kind of their non-well-preserving comparison in terms of the trophic location. And obviously that's pretty broad because they, as we'll talk about, have a pretty wide range of positions within the trophic ecosystem as well. But very much a limnological fixture and really important primary consumers in a lot of cases, but also some predatory species in lake ecosystems that leave all sorts of different stuff behind. And that's from someone who's never really worked on, I've done a little bit of cladocerin work, far, far, far less than Adam. That's one of the really very different things about the cladocerins from a paleo perspective that we'll talk about.
Yeah, and so in terms of paleo indicators, as Josh alluded to there, basically most of my graduate research and most of my postgraduate research had a cladocerin bent to it all, beginning both in a general limnological sense where my master's I was doing net hauls, trying to capture certain subtypes of cladocerins to examine their calcium content, and then eventually switching to a paleo sense, looking at the same guys or gals and the record of their community changes through time in the sediments. And the group is quite diverse, I guess, in terms of scale, nowhere near as diverse as the diatoms that we've talked about. But in terms of their trophic status, they're considerably larger. Many of them are herbivores, including really the ones that I've always been most interested in are planktonic filter feeders. There are some predatory species as well. They're found pretty much everywhere within limnological systems, whether you're talking about species in the open water, species that are associated with vegetation, species that like to live on rocks and sand and mud, pretty much all aspects of the lake. You're going to encounter some specialist cladocera as well, well designed to take advantage of that in those particular locations.
Yeah, exactly. Just a huge, well, potential then, kind of thinking ahead to when we usually discuss these more from a paleo indicator perspective, to reconstruct habitats across the ecosystem in the open water, but at multiple trophic levels too, which is not something that you would get with the diatoms. They're all going to be, well, we have the habitat range, obviously, in the chemistry range, they are all primary producers. So here we have a wide range of different habit or different feeding strategies, which is something you get with animals as an indicator that you just don't with plant-like algal organisms.
Yeah. And I guess one thing we'll come back to, but to stress earlier, they have very much an intermediate trophic position. Again, they're the dominant algal grazers in a lot of aquatic systems, or one of the dominant algal grazers. But at the same time, as we climb up the food chain, they're also a principal prey item of small fish and invertebrate predators. And they are dominant within, or not dominant, they're very commonly found, or a large component of the aquatic food webs. And one of the reasons for this is they have a very, aspects of their life cycle are very well adapted to rapid reproduction, because most of the time they are reproducing through parthenogenesis, which is a case where an adult female will produce unfertilized eggs that all develop into basically identical clones of the mother. And they will have broods of, it depends on how favorable conditions are, but you know, it's not unusual to see double-digit numbers in terms of brood sacs, and they're able to produce a brood every couple of days to a week when conditions are really, really good. And so that means these communities can respond very rapidly to changes in the environment, basically just explode in numbers when conditions are good. And we'll put a link in the show notes, but one figure that I used really like to show when talking about cladocerans in, you know, introduction to invertebrate paleo type classes is a figure from Wetzel, one of the classic limnological texts, and using some back of the envelope calculations for grazing rates for Daphna density plus the volume of the lake. There's an example lake in there where there's a figure that shows at the peak in summer, a peak Daphna density, 300% of the lake volume was being filtered every day by the cladocera community alone.
That's crazy. That's not a small lake. And it shows both of those things are important. There's just so many of them, and they're such efficient grazers on the algae in the water that they can clean the lake three times a day. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And so because of that, you know, that is just, again, underlining what we've said a couple times already, that they're very important components of these lake ecosystems.
Yeah. And you talked about that most of the year they are producing, or under most conditions, most of the year, I guess that makes sense, parthenogenic clones of themselves. But that's not the case. It's not that there aren't males of these individual species. They do exist, but they fill a very specific role in the life cycle. That has to do with a loss of those really favorable conditions.
Yeah. And this is where I'm kind of getting out of my lane a little bit, because I don't know very much about in terms of the physiological cues that lead to the creation of males. But basically, my understanding is you have this otherwise matriarchal society of lots of identical female clones. But then something happens as conditions deteriorate, whether it's related to temperature or light or food availability, so just a general stress signal of some kind leads to some males being produced somehow. And this is where I'm going to plead ignorance on exactly how it happens. And basically, they only live long enough to fertilize the eggs. So then you have this brief burst of sexual reproduction that will happen in the fall. And the results of that sexual reproduction is a different kind of egg, a diapausing or resting egg that can overwinter in the sediments.
Yeah, and if you've ever looked through a number of different kind of indicator slides, it's possible you've seen those as a paleolimnologist, these resting resting eggs that are produced. And the idea is that when conditions become favorable the next year or after some sort of stressor, those will hatch and continue on the cycle as before. But also they can remain in the sediments in the egg bank, so to speak, for longer than that. And we'll talk about that at the end, that that's an exciting sub-discipline, I guess, of paleolimnology.
Yeah. And just to roll back, one statement you said there, I think many people, again, going back to like the general public kind of familiarity or lack of familiarity with the colostrums. If you've ever been up on a lake, and again, all my examples are like South Central Ontario kind of areas, but in the fall, you'll see a lot of foam being whipped up on the beaches or on the lake shores. If you take a close look, even just with a naked eye, at that foam, next time you walk by one, you might see lots of small browny black specks in it. And if you were to look at those specks under a microscope, then you would notice they're actually Ephippia or the diapausing eggs, because they're also big enough to be seen with the naked eye. Although you're not going to be able to make out many of the details, but that basically a lot of them are produced.
Well, I didn't know that. There you go. Learned something new. I mean, I know what the foamy stuff is. We get that all the time. But no, I'm going to be looking for foam at the edges of the lake in the fall.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's lots of other crap that can be caught up in the foam. Sure. But some of it will be Ephippia for sure.
Cool. There you go.
Yeah. And there is lots of interest, again, because of the huge impact they have on lake ecosystems, of interest in the colostrum from a limnological perspective in the most broad sense. But when you dig into the colostrum from a paleolimnological sense, it definitely seems that all roads lead back to David Fry.
Did we talk about him in the history of paleolimnology series much? I don't know that we did, huh?
I think we may have name-checked him.
Yeah.
And again, I guess in hindsight, looking back on that arc, we had a huge diatom focus. And I think Cladocera would have been thrown out as like, you know, when other indicators kind of blossomed in terms of interest, or interest spread beyond the early work. And we may have referred to him, but I guess he warranted more focus than we gave him. I'll say, definitely can say that much.
Because
he's one of the...
In our defense, this is as good a time as any for one. But as you trace the sort of arc of the development of paleolimnology, it is pretty closely tied to the diatom. So I think we can get away with it. But you can't talk about cladocerans without talking about Fry. I'm not sure how to pronounce it even.
I think it's Fry. I mean, I'll be willing to take any angry emails. It's one of those names that I've seen written a billion times. I've talked about him with
stacks
people on multiple occasions and heard it both ways, but I'm pretty sure in conversations with Johnny, referred to him as David Fry.
It's probably the only person F-E-R-Y. We know who's met him. That makes sense. Yeah. We should listen.
But I don't, I'll.
But then again, he pronounces my name wrong all the time, and I've told him straight to his face.
He's told me I pronounce my name wrong.
Fair enough. Okay, so we'll just continue on here. But Professor Fry was a researcher and an early paleolimnologist in terms of kind of synthesizing material, and really was almost solely interested in all of this as a tool to better understand the taxonomy of his beloved cladocerans, in particular the chidorids, and understand not just the taxonomy of them, though he was, if you are studying cladocerans, reading papers on their taxonomy will very likely have his name as probably the only author, actually. Yeah. But also understanding the distribution of those species.
Yeah, like he was very much a taxonomist. And if you read those, go back into like the earlier papers that you'll encounter, it's very much focused on distinguishing between different species of chidorids. And then also it branches in, his research just really branched into the biogeography and questioning whether some of the species that were widely recognized as cosmopolitan were actually cosmopolitan in terms of things like Chidora sphericus. Like, is what was being called Chidora sphericus in Europe really the same as what was being called Chidora sphericus in North America?
Right.
And, you know, it's the short answer to a long story is no, but that's kind of beyond the scope of what we're talking about here. But his interest in cladocerans and isolating cladocerin remains, it was really his road into paleolimnology. It was kind of the reverse of many of the other paleolimnologists at the time, that they were interested in what paleolimnology could tell them about environmental change.
Yeah.
And he was much more interested in what paleolimnology could tell him about what was living in the lake at any given time.
So like a sediment core would provide him with all sorts of remains that he could then distill down to their taxonomic characteristics, whereas it's quite hard to go and take lots of net toes. It's time consuming. You may not get all the different species. And we found in, was this in the deeper book that this quote came out of? You want to read it?
Yeah. And so just to kind of characterize what we're getting at here, as a quote in Deeper from 1960, but it's basically where he's saying, a list of species, at least chidorids, occurring in a given body of water can be attained with the least expenditure of time and greatest assurance of completeness from an examination of the sediments. So his interest is very much limnological, but using the sediments to as the means of generating the most complete samples of the chidorids. And I guess we not mentioned this earlier, but many of these species are that he was most interested in would be the kinds most associated with vegetation or various substrates. So that you'd actually be some of the least likely that you might find through a net haul. And so in that way, collecting a sediment core was a lot easier than going out and scrubbing rocks to get your samples from a given lake.
Yep, which worked for studying the species, but also works quite nicely and indicates, I think quite well, that they are a faithful record of what is found in the lake, not just in the water column, but in many and perhaps all of the different habitats that they would be living as alive individuals.
So with all that background on the cladocerans and, you know, when we eventually get the show notes up, you've got references, and we'll provide references so you can dig into that taxonomy and whatnot at your leisure. But bringing it all back to paleo, I thought the next part of the show is going to focus on just, and as we've been doing in these small picture arcs, is just how do you isolate them and what preserves, and not just why are we interested in these organisms, but what can you get and how do you get it? So for the cladocerans, at least, what preserves? Well, basically body parts. This is the first one I think we've talked about in the series in a while where we're dealing with subfossils. You will very rarely find a complete animal. Or you'll never find a complete animal because none of the whole animal actually preserves. You're dealing with bits and pieces, and they're the heavily chitinized bits and pieces. So things like their head shields, their carapace, their post-abdomens, their post-abdominal claws. And again, these are crustaceans. So basically they have, you know, their skeletons are on the outside of their body. And some of those skeletons preserve quite well in sediments.
Yep. I mean, diatoms split into two, and that's about it. Like, you have the two halves of the frustule, the two different valves, they split, but this is another animal entirely, you know. Not every species leaves the same remains behind. The all primarily related to the degree of chitinization or how chitinized they are. Chitin is a polysaccharide. It's, I think, the second most common polysaccharide on Earth after cellulose. It makes up, as Adam said, the exoskeletons of many invertebrates, insects, crustaceans. So it's very, very common biomolecule. But if you've ever just looked at different insects, you can see how different in terms of the degree of chitinization they can be. A beetle with its really hard shell is entirely different than some small flying insects. And you get similar things in the cladocerans. Some taxa are going to have very relatively well chitinized parts, and some much less so.
And the subfossil nature of the cladoceran, the study of cladocerans, is you're likely to find different body parts for different species. So, for example, Daphnia is a very, very common species, and the most commonly found remain that you'll find from them is a post-abdominal claw, whereas some of the chidorids that we mentioned in the previous segment, one individual will leave behind a head shield, two halves of his carapace, a post-abdomen, which may or may not have the claw attached. And so then you have to do a bit of a correction factor a lot of the time to account for how many individuals may be represented by your sample is like the most common way of dealing with this, rather than just a raw number, to account for the fact that certain taxa are on a purely numerical basis have a better chance to be represented in the sediments than others.
I think that was one of the things that I was most surprised by when I first learned, because Jenny worked on cladocera for her grad work. So I, you know, have heard much of this many times. But that at the end of a count, you know, or end of an interval, you don't just add them up and type the numbers into a spreadsheet. There's math to be done for this, to figure out which is the most abundant of the remains of a given species, indicating the likely number and figuring out that kind of component. Yeah, so there's a little bit more that goes into it than your diatomists out there might be familiar with.
Yeah. And in terms of isolating the remains from the sediments, that is where one of the... if the counting is a little more complicated, the isolation is much more simpler than the procedure you would use for diatoms. You're not dealing with anything too nasty, and you're not actually digesting anything. Basically, you're going to try and break up the sediments or deflocculate your sediment samples in a weak, like 5%, 10% solution of potassium hydroxide, and then sieve the samples, preserving the residue that catches on the sieve. Usually, so in the deeper volume, it said the official kind of deeper method, I guess, would be 50 micrometer mesh size. I think ours is a bit smaller than that. But in terms of just capturing the residue, add it to a vial, add a little bit of a saffron dye so they stand out a little bit more on the slides, and then pipette individual aliquots onto a slide for identification. So the whole nitric sulfuric acid mix, hydrofluoric acid mix, those are steps are completely not completely used gone, at all. Yeah, because those would destroy the
yeah, exactly. And you don't have to worry about it's not like pollen where you have to get rid of the diatoms so you can see them. The diatoms just go right through the sieve. They're, you know, the very largest one might end up on there if you were in a lake loaded with Didymo. But that's not a real problem. You keep behind the big stuff and let the small stuff sort through. And you will get pollen on these slides and things like that, and they stain nicely with the same dyes. But yeah, that is quite different. Basically washing them in soap to clean up the remains and putting them on something and having a look. And you go through a lot more slides was the other thing that I always found. Like in a lot of cases, when you're making slides for an interval, you would be making multiple because the remains are less abundant, even though there's lots of them, than things like diatoms or pollen. You might make 10 slides of a given interval. and you would count all of those as opposed to, it's a really bad interval if you have to count more than a single cover slip. It's in most cases, a couple of transects for diatoms.
But you're also working at a lower magnification.
Yep.
So that an individual cover slip goes a lot faster because you're,
the field of view is much larger.
Much slower, yeah. And you're potentially scanning with your 20 times and dropping into your 40 times for IDing or something to that effect. So on the one hand, it sounds horror, like a order of magnitude more work, but it's not actually the case in practice.
Very true.
And another key thing in terms of the isolation, which I found quite interesting, so I switched fairly late in the game to doing chronobit analyses and going from having to do lots of slides to, or not lots, but multiple slides in order to get a viable cladosterone count, then running into situations where after doing the chronobit prep, which we'll talk about in another episode, basically having to sift through all the cladosterone crap that made its way through trying to find the chronomids I was interested
in. Get out of the way, Kydora shell.
Pretty much. And it's like when you look at like one individual chronomid tray and you go, geez, there's like, you know, just in, without even doing any count, I know there's like 10,000 cladosterone remains in here. And so it's kind of, scale is everything, I guess.
Oh, and I guess we never fleshed out what is the kind of goal for a count number, where we talked about like 400 or 500 diatoms, 300 to 500 diatoms. What are we looking at for cladocera in ideal circumstances? Not really crazy ones.
Yeah. I think, so there's some variance, depending on how you quantify in terms of number of remains, is what we ran into when I was first starting. But then, I don't know, like 10, 12 years ago, Josh Keurig led a study kind of, and it was largely in terms of theoretical, like within a given sample, at what point, how many do you need to adequately characterize the assemblage? Yep. And the number you settled on was about 100.
The diminishing returns kind of study, like you're not finding anything new, even if you may add one more taxa. Cool. There you go.
And that kind of lines up just by and large with 300 body parts most of the time quite well, which was, I don't know if it's recommended in the Koholon ratio chapter, but somewhere along the line, 300 seemed to be a bit of a magic number. And then when you're actually doing it for individuals, it kind of lined up quite nicely in the end. So
perfect. There you go. Yeah. And then kind of moving on, I think we've covered the lab work there. Let's start thinking about what it is you can do with all of this great data that you've collected from a paleo perspective, limnological perspective.
So compared to the pollen and diatoms we've already talked about in this arc, I think one of the key takeaways is that cladocerin paleo analyses and the interpretations of the cladocerin paleo record, by and large, is more qualitative than quantitative. There are definitely transfer functions that have been used in terms of the cladocerins, but you are typically talking about a much smaller community. So you're talking about dozens of species rather than hundreds of species in a given sediment core. And so it becomes one of those things of, people have developed transfer functions to infer temperature changes, lake depth changes, and things like that. But the cladocerin transfer functions would not be the ideal tool in any of those, in pretty much any case, because using like the diatoms or something like that, you're going to just have a much better model performance.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like you couldn't. For many of them, there may be some physiological connection, but the benefits of using the diatoms or chrysophytes or some other algal indicator in terms of just the number of species, the more easily definable tolerances, and the less connection with things like higher trophic levels, which are going to be influencing as well, which is not really, you know, we'll talk about it in a minute, but the grazing away of the diatoms is not really a control on their species, on their abundance in the vast, vast majority of conditions, is not the same for the Cladocera.
Yeah. And because of that, it just has changes the kind of questions that are asked. And so a lot of the paleo work that you'll encounter very much focuses on changes within the planktonic taxa a lot of the time. And some of the most commonly encountered planktonic taxa that you'll find in temperate regions are members of the Bosminidae and the Daphnidae, Bosminids and Daphnids. And so like the classic example of this would be using that intermediate trophic position to provide information on trophic interactions or trophic cascades. And an example would be Levitt et al., 1989, looking at Paul Lake in, oh my goodness, my Americans, is that Michigan or Minnesota? That's Michigan. That's Michigan. Yeah, Minnesota is MN. The kind of the study is doing a multi-proxy analysis, but in terms of the Cladocera component of it, they're looking at a lake that was exposed to rotenone to eliminate the native fish population so that it could be stocked with lake trout, and that changed the dominant piscivore. And then all of a sudden, it led to Daphnia, which is the larger of those two Cladocerans, Bosmina versus Daphnia, all of a sudden becoming the dominant Cladocera because it released it from the pressure of zooplanktivores, or the smaller fish and minnows, because the lake trout ate them up, basically. So you had a trophic cascade effect that lasted for a little while until a particularly bad winter kill eliminated the lake trout from the lake, leading to a resurgence among the planktivores, which then in turn allowed the Bosmina to rise because all of a sudden it was a competitive advantage to be smaller, basically, so you're less likely to be eaten by visual predators until the lake was restocked with largemouth bass and then flipping the conditions again. And so then you have that kind of trophic cascade through time reflected in the Cladocera record. And so those are the kind of questions and relationships that you're more likely to see the Cladocera used for, as opposed to a long-term reconstruction of a given variable.
Yeah, they're really common in those kind of food web visualization diagrams to see. This one goes up, the top predators or the piscivores goes up, this one goes down, the planktivores, which means the large Cladocerans are going to go up because they're, you know, they're much easier to see, they're easier to eat, they're more energetic in terms of the food quality for or planktivores. And then there might be some impact on the primary producing community, the algae, not just diatoms in this case, the whole ecosystem, algae in terms of the feeding, grazing efficiency of those taxa. So that could be reflected in paleo indicators, either in the algae or in things like the changes in pigments, inferring production. So I'm sure the Levitt et al. Paper has multiple trophic levels in it that talk about all of those different things, but from a Cladocera perspective, the shift back and forth between these different planktivore groups based on the trophic pressure is a really classic example of that use.
Absolutely. And the Cladocerans are also well studied with respect to acidification. In a lot of cases, they would not be good pH indicators because they're not particularly well suited to low pH conditions. So instead of seeing a replacement of, circumneutral cladocerans with acidophilic cladocerans, basically you see the elimination of cladocerans in a lot of acidification or heavy acidification. And then that has always been one of the interests from a limnological point of view in places like the Dorset A lakes, where you've got lake halls of the zooplankton going back to the late 70s and tracking changes through time and the long-term recovery of lakes from acidification there versus in the general vicinity of Sudbury, just Colossus from being eliminated and gradually returning over time, hopefully, although that's where I came in my graduate studies, looking at potential reasons why they might not be. And one of those is calcium decline. Because in addition to being heavily chitinized, they have large amounts of calcium in their carapaces. And so that may be limiting their recovery in a lot of saltwater lakes that were impacted by acidification. There's also a variety of, or an angle of study looking at UV penetration in alpine systems, looking at differences in pigmentation between various cladostrin species in the paleo record and changes over time. And then just in recent years, a huge proliferation in multi-proxy analyses all over the place, looking at climate warming, and cladostrins are often, very commonly included in multi-proxy analyses to compare, as Josh mentioned, with relation to the fish stocking exercise, but just seeing what they are doing because they're a different trophic level than things like the cladostrins and chrysophytes and whatnot.
I think the UV one is a cool example. Anytime I've like, often when you take a sediment core, the water sitting on the top, it has all sorts of things swimming around in it, and tend to be a lot of cladostra. And from my Arctic work, they tend to be quite big because many of the lakes are fishless, and they tend to be quite pigmented, partly because they're fishless, because the darker pigmentation of the cladostrins make them even easier prey, especially when they're big ones, for fish, but also as a result of the fact that it's in the Arctic. So in the summer, the sun is shining 24 hours. Well, it's not always sunny, but the sun, it's bright 24 hours a day. And so they would require this pigmentation, or they would benefit from this pigmentation as a basically sunscreen against the UV impacts in those really shallow, well-lit ecosystems. And the only other thing I was thinking of just as we were going through this, I would, not that Jenny listens to the podcasts, but if she did, she would probably make a pitch for the fact that there are some other things that can be done. So some of her work looked at the size of different components of the subfossils, different subfossils. So the length of the carapace or the antennule length of some of these things. So there are some more quantitative components because they're big enough that you can measure them. And unlike diatoms, which we talked about, where the size of the valve is not really that useful, there can be some changes because they get within individual groups, they can get bigger, for example, related to predation pressures. So got to put that pitch in there.
Good job. But yeah, so a pretty varied set of interests from a paleolimnological point of view for this group of small invertebrates.
All right, Adam, the key question: cladocerans, great paleo indicator or greatest paleo indicator?
So I am here today to pander to all the cladostrin fans in the audience, and I'm going to say unequivocally that they are the greatest paleo indicator. And if you disagree with me, send me a message.
That's right. There you go.
So I think recently, or a couple months ago, there was a Twitter poll in like the paleolimnology set of what the greatest one was. And I think
I didn't see that.
The cladostrins did not win. It was an outright tragedy of just modern science, really.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they weren't paying attention on that day to get really strongly behind it, or it's more of a kind of nuclear, smaller group of researchers, which is probably the case compared to some of the others. So one loss there, but maybe in this poll, they will come out on top. But lots of interesting things about them is that, and we talked about a little bit at the beginning, is that, from a I don't know, is resurrection ecology, which I think is maybe not the greatest kind of paleo indicator, but it's one of the coolest things you can do with lake sediments. Is that considered paleolimnology, or where does it fall in your opinion?
It definitely is like one of the, it's really hard to say, because on one level it is. And so to bring everyone up to speed on what we're talking about in resurrection ecology, it's like this really cool application of taking advantage of the resting eggs. So there are multiple studies out there that will basically collect a sediment core, go to some known depth of interest in the sediments, isolate just the aphibia, and these remain viable for, I'm not sure what the longest is. I think in the individual single egg that I've seen is on the order of somewhere between like 200 and 300 years old.
Yeah, I think that's right. Something around there.
And so I'm not sure if that one was a freak in terms of its age, or there's a fair number from that depth, but definitely on the order of like 100 years ago. And so in terms of like comparing pollution or responses to pollution over time in some way, you can, and again, remembering these are clonal females, so if you get the same species, theoretically, not a whole lot will have changed, because there wouldn't have been that many instances of sexual reproduction through time. Like, yes, you're talking about 100 years ago and a jabillion generations, but most of them will have been clonal generations. And you're able to compare the response of a modern individual to a resurrected copy of their great, 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 to some insane number of greats grandmother. And measure their responses to a variety of stresses.
Yeah, it's crazy that you just take out these little things, you hatch them, which hatching aphibia is not hard. Hatching old aphibia is quite hard. There's a lot of work that goes into that. But generally speaking, rearing Daphnia, anyone can do that to feed their fish. Well, you know, it can be done. In certain species. And again, it all comes down to which taxa you're talking about, the conditions and that sort of thing. But if you can get to that stage, which is the hard part, and you have now this group of individuals that are genetically the same as when that egg was deposited 50 years ago, you can test them against modern conditions, or you can test them against the conditions from them. Were they better adapted to metal pollution than modern species are?
Due to the development of a mine in the catchment.
Yeah. Or all, you know, the potential is almost what you can imagine, because you have this population of clones that you can then be used for, in a lot of cases, ecotoxicological types of investigation. So I think one of the coolest uses of sediments, though a little bit outside of the classical definition of paleolimnology.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's definitely one of those things where I've, seeing or working in close proximity with individuals that were working to culture Daphne through time, and the trials and tribulations that they encounter in terms of air conditioners failing in the hottest week of the summer and stuff like that. It's definitely a subset of science that I was always much more interested in reading about than actually being involved in myself. But some of this stuff is very, very cool.
Yeah.
And in terms of like another kind of like cladocerin tangent that I guess never really had, it doesn't really have a whole lot of paleo aspects to it, but we alluded that in the intro that a lot more people may be more familiar with the cladocera than they realize, because one of the most famous cladocerins, definitely in this region of the world, is an invasive species. So if you're going to any boat launches anywhere around here, you're probably likely to see signs of stop the spread of Bitho, which is a reference to Bithotrephes longimanus. It's a taxa that is native to Northern Europe, I believe, and or not, I believe it's native to Northern Europe and like Caspian Sea maybe area or the Caucasus regions, somewhere in there. But the point is, it's not from around here, and was introduced to the Great Lakes through ballast water from shipping, international shipping in the 1980s. And now we're seeing, I'm not sure if this is where I'm not up on the literature to the level that I'm able to really point out dates, but I'm pretty sure it arrived in the Great Lakes in the 1980s. And by 1992-ish, it had been observed in the Muskoka region, and then a lot of kind of its spread has been documented to all the small lakes in central Ontario, and it's largely tied to spread through anglers that are just very similar to the zebra mussels. It's just hitching rides on boats in a little bit of water that gets caught in the boat when you go from lake to lake. And again, we mentioned these gals can reproduce clonally, so you don't need to introduce, you know, you don't need a whole lot of them to have a successful establishment. And so you're seeing a definite spread through a big chunk of North America.
Yeah, and we talked about them being called water fleas, and this one is usually colloquially referred to as the spiny water flea. And that's the other thing. It attaches, because it's the long tail spine is pokey, it'll attach to fishing gear too, because like, they're big for Cladocera, which we could talk about in a second, but they're not that big. So you could have quite a few of them on your fishing tackle or lines or nets or whatever you have, or boat. Like bumpers, those kind of things. So there's lots and lots of places that this relatively large Cladocera, but relatively small invasive species, can get lodged in order to get easily moved around between lakes.
Yeah, and I guess we're not mentioned yet. This is a predator species, and is actually a voracious predator in some cases. So you have lakes in the Muskoka region of Ontario where the native Cladocera community has actually been decimated by the introduction of Bitho, which is, you know, when you look at them in culture, or it's kind of hard to imagine how voraciously predators they are, because they're just like, you know, they're just a long spine and they seem to be fairly clumsy swimmers, but I think they're just eating machines.
Yep.
And
biology is crazy.
Yeah. And interestingly, there's not a huge amount of paleo work done on Bitho. There's definitely some analyses looking at, do they preserve? And the tail spines definitely do. But I think what's interesting is, and I've never really seen this ever published or really discussed anywhere, but it's kind of funny in that because they are so big, I think they're the standard Cladocera paleo analysis would actually exclude them. So yep. the pipetting step of, you know, taking Cladocera out of your vial and putting them onto individual slides. At that point, you're not going to suck up very many of the tail mm-hmm. spines. So you're actually more likely to find the tail spines in like chironomid samples than in Cladocera samples.
Makes sense. Yep. And getting towards the end of this here, though we could probably talk for hours and hours about all the different uses. But one of the things that kind of often comes up is the idea that, you know, Cladocera are sort of a general stand-in for zooplankton. You know, from a paleo perspective, if you talk about zooplankton, someone's referring to the Cladocera. But that's not really the case from a limnological perspective. That's something to keep in mind. And, you know, as we get to things like paleo DNA, we'll be able to deal with this a little bit better. But copepods and rotifers, which are huge groups, more speciose, certainly in terms of the copepods, I don't know that much about rotifers, than Cladocera, are in many lakes probably dominant In terms of numbers, maybe not grazing, because some of the filter feeding cladocera are very efficient grazers in comparison to rotifers, but those groups just don't preserve. So, you know, from a paleo perspective, that's sort of this, that's not a bias per se, but it is the interpretation of it.
And, you know, this leads quite nicely into a question we got in the main mailbag. And so we got a question from Ben, who's asking us, you know, at some point, could we talk about comparing like the modern record or net hauls versus the sediments? And
it's a great topic.
Know, it is, you know, like, and the cladocera lend themselves right to it. And so we'll just, you know, maybe talk about it for another minute or so here in a general sense, but it's definitely fodder for its own show. But it's just a case of there's no way to really avoid apples to oranges comparisons. And when you're dealing with the sediments versus the water column, and the cladocera really illustrate it, because as we mentioned in the quote from David Fry, you know, you're going to get a complete record of the cladocera and the sediments. That's part of the draw. And as we've mentioned, there are a huge number of cladocera that like to hang out on various substrates and in among the vegetation in the littoral zone. And if you drop a net haul in the center of the lake, you're simply not going to capture those species that would be captured in the record. And then on top of that, you have potential blooms. So what you will get in a sample from the water column, like if you go back to the Heart Lake example on the absolute peak day when they're filtering the entire volume of the lake three times a day, you're going to get a huge amount of Daphnia on that particular day than you would if you went like a month later. And in terms of your relative abundance of various species will vary, which in of itself is may or may not be interested to your question. But if you're trying to compare, you know, your July 1st net haul record to the of 2021 to the 2021 sediment slice, that sediment slice, instead of having any one day, will basically be having an integrated average of the full season.
Yeah, that's definitely a topic for its own show, but they do a pretty good job of illustrating some of the challenges in just even from a habitat perspective, but a temporal perspective. Lots to try and think of, and in some cases, it, you know, the answer to that whole show might be like it's really hard and may not be possible to do.
And well, I've done it a little bit, but it's always going to be the fuzziness, because there'll never be a perfect match. But anyway, we'll delve into this in detail,
put our thoughts together fall, and
yeah, and thanks for writing in, Ben. Really appreciate it. All right, so once again, thank you for listening to Core Ideas, the podcast dedicated to all things paleolimnology. If you'd like to reach out to us with a question or a comment, please send us an email to coreideaspodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can contact us through Twitter at Core Ideas Paleo. There's only one A in paleo.
All of our past episodes, along with their corresponding show notes or blog posts, can be found on our website at coreideas.ajeziorski.ca. I could spell it out, but just pull it up on our Twitter page.
You'll find it there. If you're so inclined, give us a rating or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, wherever you're getting these podcasts. A 5-star rating would be great, but to be honest, we don't really care all that much. We're just doing this for fun.
Because we're mega nerds.
Yeah, and pretty much.
And that's it for now. But join us again next time as we continue to explore paleolimnology in the knowledge economy era, sticking to our ethos of pure knowledge without the economy.